My name's Sarah Howard Parker, and I'm the Director of Operations at the Boston Book Festival. We are so happy to be back in the beautifully renovated Boston Public Library. Look at this place. It's amazing. My job is really to organize all of the logistics of the festival, so hopefully the stuff that you guys don't have to think about, the lighting and where all these events are going to take place and our volunteer staffing, all of that great stuff. And we're very lucky to have our volunteers here today to donate their time. But many of these things are not donated, unfortunately. We do pay for rental space in many of our venues. This is probably the most beautiful venue that we have this year, and it's all brand new lighting, brand new sound. For most of our other spaces, we are bringing all of that stuff in, and it's really expensive. So this is my plea for money. How's it going? I'm hoping you guys will consider donating to the festival today, because we do really want to keep this event free and open to the public. It's an important part of our mission, and we'd love your help in doing so. And we have a really fun way for you to donate, which you will find more information about this at our merchandise booth, but we are doing a raffle this year. So you may win a prize, perhaps even one you can drive away on. And our raffle tickets are starting at just $10, so we hope that you will consider supporting us at any level. And thank you so much for being here. It's a beautiful day, and we're so happy to share it with you. It's my great pleasure to introduce Kelly Horan from WBUR. I hope you enjoy the panel. Thanks very much.
Thank you all so much for coming. It's great to look out and see so many people. In my dream last night, there were only three. So already it's going better. And it's my honor to share the stage with these beautiful authors who've each written a profound and moving book on very different subjects, but I think as we talk today, we'll find some of the through lines for each. I'll start with Gerald at the end. Gerald Walker is the author of The World in Flames, A Black Boyhood in a White Supremacist Cult. He is a professor of creative writing at Emerson College, and his first memoir, Street Shadows, a memoir of race, rebellion, and redemption, won the Penn New England Award for nonfiction. And it's great to have you here, Gerald. Thank you. Next to Gerald is Elizabeth Marshall Thomas. She's the author of 11 books that have shared with us the inner lives of all sorts of creatures, great and small, dogs, big cats, everything in between. Her newest book is Dreaming of Lions, My Life in the Wild Places, which takes us from the woods of New Hampshire to the Kalahari Desert and back again. Liz, it's great to have you. William Giraldi is the author of The Hero's Body. He's also the author of two previous works of fiction, Busy Monsters and Hold the Dark. He's the fiction editor of Agni at Boston University. And I'm going to steal your own words about your book. The book is about motorcycles and muscles and the imprecations of masculinity, yes, but it's also a love song to literature. So we're going to find out what that means in a few minutes.
I said that?
Yeah, you did. Sounded good.
Wondering why it sounded so good.
Howard Axelrod, next to me, is the author of The Point of Vanishing, a memoir of 2 years in solitude. Howard, after having an accident in college, decided to move to the woods of Vermont a couple of years later and spend his time completely alone, except for the odd expedition to the grocery store to catch up on Elton John's latest, I guess. Geraldine Brooks called this memoir witty, wise, and beautifully written, and that only scratches the surface. It is an extraordinary book. So, Howie, welcome.
Thank you.
I mentioned that each of these books is different, but there is sort of a through line, and one of them is paying attention. And I know, Liz, you talk about in the opening of your book keeping your eyes open, and each of you, in your way, addresses this question of being alive to what's happening. And I want to talk about this in memoir in general, because what occurs to me is that we live in an age of distractions, and if we're distracted, we can't be taking in the moment. And so I don't know if one of you wants to talk about memoir as an act of observation first. Go for it.
If you were waiting for me to say something on that subject, I do think it's very valuable. I think it's, well, being in the moment is one of the most important things you can do as a way to live. It helps with all kinds of things, and it's the way the rest of the world lives. It's the way animals live in the woods. And with awareness of what's going on, and they have to have it to a much greater degree than we do. So did the early hunter-gatherers, our ancestors, when they were hunter-gatherers on the African savannah. It was very important for them to live in the moment, but to be aware of what was going on around them, for the same reason that it's important for wildlife to do that, for animals. What I was fascinated by, having written a memoir, was how much I learned about myself, which I had not seen in the moment many years earlier. Excuse me. How much my dad, I had a wonderful father, nobody could ask for a better father, but how much he had to do with who I am today. It just came as a big surprise. I didn't anticipate that. I hadn't known that, but gosh, luckily for me, that was true, because he was a very good person. And it was, and the other thing that was surprising about it is that, okay, you write your memoir, everything you put down, all this stuff that happened, you write the end, and then you look at your grocery list, you need to buy eggs and you need to buy milk and some bread. Go into town, come back with the bread and the milk, and in that time, things have changed so tremendously that your whole life looks different, everything is different, everything changed. That happened to me very much so. It wasn't quite overnight, but it was very, very soon after. So I wrote an afterword, and that stuff is all in the afterword. Maybe I've said enough about
it. So I'll give you maybe an illustration. I walked by a funeral not long ago in Cambridge. I stopped at the gates there to look, as I typically do with funerals. And there was a 16, 17-year-old boy there. From the way others were trying to console him, I could tell that he was pretty close to the deceased. Whether it was apparent or not, I'm not sure. But I stood there to watch for a while, and the entire time he was there, he had his phone up between him and everything that was happening. He was tapping and swiping and filming, tapping and swiping and filming. I watched for about a half an hour, and for the entire half an hour, this illuminated rectangle was in between himself and his surroundings. And I thought, there's one more potential memoirist ruined. One more potential imaginative writer ruined, because he won't have in the future any Proustian trigger to access this event, because he didn't really experience it. I considered that this was something of a defense mechanism, that this phone was placed there in order to shield him from the grief. And there's that, but to not be experiencing this burial of a loved one, in terms of paying attention, which is what you began with, Kelly, it's for the memoirist, I would say, for any imaginative writer, it's the first item. Pay attention, right?
That's so true about the cell phone in front of your face. Thanks for saying that. That's good.
I completely agree. I mean, I think when we talk about paying attention, we talk about the benefit in the moment, in lots of ways. The benefit for the person who's paying attention, the benefit to the people around the person who's paying attention in the way of empathy. But there's also the benefit months later, years later, if the person wants to become a memoirist. Good luck to that person. But also just if the person, as we all do, is trying to make sense of her life. And in order to make sense of your life, you have to look back on it, which means you need to have taken time in the moment to pay attention, even when it's painful to pay attention. And it also means later, you have to take time to pay attention to those moments when you paid attention. Or possibly even, I mean, maybe that guy years later will slow down, will put his device to the side, unlikely, but maybe, and then he'll pay attention to the moments when he didn't pay attention and have a way of making sense of that. But it seems that that impulse towards narrative, towards trying to make meaning, is common. It's not just something memoirists have. We all have that. And if you're not paying attention in the moment, and certainly if you don't have time to reflect, which is sort of paying attention in retrospect, if you don't have time for that, it becomes very hard to make sense of your life.
Maybe memoirs of the future will be people you were talking to on your cell phone and what they said to you and pictures they showed you. That could be a memoir.
Well, like
so we shouldn't give up forever.
Well, maybe the kid was looking at his first draft of the memoir. I mean, we can give him the benefit of the doubt. We don't know for sure what he was doing on that, but yeah, I pay attention to the moment, but as a memoirist, I probably spend a lot more time paying attention to the moments that have passed. And so I live life, things happen. Often the moments that will become the subject of what I write about are the moments that grab me instead of me searching for it and paying attention for it. And so the moments for me are mainly post-moments where I lie in bed at night thinking about the thing that will not let me forget it. And I try to figure out these events that insist that they're important to me, even though at the time I don't yet know how. And often that understanding happens when I start to try to put the experiences on the page so I can figure out why won't this moment in particular leave me. And then I find out its significance as I work my way through whatever it is I'm trying to sort out on the page.
I wish you'd talk a little, Gerald. I've read you quoted somewhere saying that I have this overactive imagination, and my challenge is to keep it out of what I'm writing, whether it's in fiction or nonfiction. And maybe each of you could also address this question of the imagination as it applies to the moment from the past and how much time affects how you see it, how you felt it, how much how you want it to look affects your retelling of it.
Well, my imagination is a beast, and it's difficult for me to contain it, which explains in some large part why my fiction was less successful than I would have wanted it to be. I'll give an example. I have a twin brother who married a heroin addict. And one night, his heroin addict wife, Hai, tried to stab him. And she thrust a knife at him. It caught him on the thumb, which was nearly severed, but it stayed on. And I thought, this is awesome as material. Sure, I felt bad for my brother, but my first concern is as an artist. And so I started writing this as a short story, and I typed, and the knife came toward him and severed his thumb, which flew through the air like a... And it completely went out of control, because I couldn't resist the urge to make a thing that was important more important. The reason why nonfiction suits me better is because of that. That I need the boundaries of fact and of something that actually happened to keep me sort of within the lanes of the story. And I can use my imagination in the way I tell the facts that were given to me by life.
You know, at the beginning of his autobiography, G.B. Shaw, in a typically Shavian bit of acuity, said, "All autobiographies are lies. I don't mean accidental lies, I mean deliberate lies."
I think four in this room weren't.
I think it's one of the things where memoirs are constantly having to confront is this idea of truth, or where does imagination factor into it? You know, imagination can't factor into the facts, right? You've got to say it as it happened. Where imagination, I think, comes into play when you can't change the details, when you can't alter the truth, is on really the only level that matters, which is language. How imaginative is your linguistic rendering of what has happened to you? Structurally speaking, how imaginative is the armature of your book? How well does it assert yourself, not just express yourself, which I think is pretty simple. Self-expression is quite simple. Self-assertion, I think, is something else again. This marshaling of not just your emotional faculties, but your intellectual and spiritual faculties as well, to bring all of you, the entirety of your selfhood, to bear on the page. I think if I have an issue with so much contemporary memoir, especially the ones that make the biggest splashes, you know the ones I mean, they're made into Hollywood films, is that they're all self-expression without too much self-assertion. They're barrages of emotion, right? And so I think for me, at least what I try to do is push back against that a little bit and bring the entirety of my selfhood to bear on the page, which I say is not just a matter of how do you feel, but rather what do you think? And where does the spirit come into play here? So I hope that's getting a little bit at imagination.
And it's getting to a place that I was hoping to talk about with all of you, which is about memoir as a form, which we might agree or disagree that's having a heyday. I don't know, but it hasn't always been a revered art form, and I think that it's a form that some have tried to stay away from. So what makes a memoir an out form? You know, Mary Carr called it the province of weirdos and saints, and outsiders' art. What rescues memoir from the margins and makes it an art form, in your opinion? Is it the interpretation of memory? Is it the self-assertion that you talk about, William? What is it?
I think it actually, part of it has to do with imagination. Actually, so I was thinking, listening to what you all were saying, that I used my imagination a lot when I wrote my memoir. In part, I needed to use my visual imagination to try to remember specifically what did it look like mm-hmm. when I was living in the woods, when I would go on these walks, when I would sit by the wood stove. And I would try to use that visual imagination to trigger emotional, you know, sort of how did it feel? Mm-hmm. What was my state of mind? What was sort of the state of being? Because mm-hmm. my book, in a lot of ways, is about consciousness and how consciousness can change mm-hmm. In pretty radical ways. So in order to try to evoke that feeling that I had when I was there, I really had to use my imagination quite a lot. Not imagination in the sense of dreaming up new possibilities or having my thumb fly off when I was carrying wood inside, but visual imagination. And then there's also, memoirists also use their imagination for speculation. I wonder what it must have been like for my mom when I was living in the woods. I wonder what it must have been like for my dad when I was living in the woods. And so part of empathy is it's not just the will to think about what did someone else feel. It's imagination, trying to figure out what they might have felt. So, and I think those kinds of imagination, visual imagination, empathetic imagination, all lead towards what we were talking about before, the effort to make meaning, the effort to try to come up with a narrative for one's life. So you can make assertions rather than just expressions. So you can have something to say about that path you took, whether it was deliberate or not, and how you make sense of it mm-hmm. afterwards, which I think is such a natural impulse.
I think about the waiting period to buy a handgun as an analogy for how long you wait before you decide to write about a certain event. You know, how hot is the event still in your mind? And the question of time passing and age also is intriguing to me. I know, William, you quote Benvenuto Cellini talking about if you're going to do an excellent thing, you should write about it, but not until you're after 40.
40, yeah.
And, you know, so when is the right time? You know, Howard, when did you know that you were going to write about this moment in the woods? William, when did you know you wanted to write about your father's death on a motorcycle? Liz, the lions of your of the 1950s that you saw for the first time in the Kalahari. Gerald, this extraordinary upbringing, wearing bells so your sightless parents could know where you were. I mean, when did you each decide that it was, now is the time to set this down for the record?
Well, I realized how old I was. It was very likely that I could write a memoir and I wouldn't have to do any research. Easy. Piece of cake. And the other thing, I was born at a very good time. I mean, my lifetime occurred at a very good time. It occurred when there was still unexplored, big unexplored areas in Africa and other parts of the world, literally unexplored, by European, Western people. The Bushmen who lived there had lived there for, one encampment was found to have been a continuous occupancy for 85,000 years and another for 35,000 years. Probably all in all about 200,000 years, and you would think they had explored it pretty well in those years, and which of course they did. They knew everything about it, but outsiders didn't. But anyway, it was a very good time to be there for that. Also, at a time when we had trucks and vehicles that we could drive in there, we didn't have to walk in there, which would have been very hard because of no surface water and so forth. Anyway, all that aside, it was. And as for making things up, I couldn't possibly have made up the stuff that I wrote about. I just wanted to have it be good enough to writing about it to make it come through. That was what I wanted. And as for art form, I just think if it sounds nice to the inner ear, when you read it, if it's sounding nice to you, that's an art form, I think. So it doesn't matter what you say. If it sounds nice. So that's my advice for writing a memoir.
When I decided to write The World in Flames, which is, as Kelly mentioned, about me being raised in the Doomsday Cult, it was a story that I avoided for many, many years. And this goes back to my first response about waiting for the moments to tell you that they're ready to be addressed. And I have two sons who are now 14 and 16. But a few years ago, when they were 8 and 10, I really started to see myself at that age. And I noticed the contrast between how happy and content and normal they seem compared to how miserable I was when I was at that age. Because it's kind of hard to be happy when you're in a doomsday cult and the world is about to end. And that would keep me up at night. Not concerned about their happiness, of course, but just the contrast between their experience and my experience. And I really became able to see myself with more clarity in watching my kids sort of acting out my life right before me. A second time. And so I, when I started writing my story, I benefited from having two kids who looked like me and sounded like me and had many of the mannerisms I'm certain I had at the same period in my life. And that helped me to get to what I needed to get to, and that was to address the unhappiness of that period, but also to find the joys of that period, which I did quite by accident.
The line to which Kelly was referring earlier is by from Cellini's magisterial autobiography, which begins with that no man, he says man, who has lived any life of excellence should begin to put it down until he reaches the age of 40. It's probably good advice. I could say that I began mine really the night my father was killed. I was 25, and I went back to my dorm room that night and I wrote a single line in a notebook. I wrote, "Absence takes up space." And for 15 years, I added to that notebook and wrote and rewrote and threw half a dozen drafts away. So the book was really 15 years in the making. But I can tell you, listening to Gerald, something very similar happened to me. You know, Schopenhauer has this great bit where he says that the first 40 years provide the substance of your life, and the next 40 years provide the commentary on that substance. Well, my father was killed at 47, and so he didn't have any time for commentary. And so when my own sons were born, I began to have this urge. I felt the onset of a duty to provide commentary on my father's life because he wasn't here to provide that commentary for himself. And I needed for my sons, I've got three small sons, I really needed for them to know what they were missing with my father's death. So all of these things coalesced, really. My turning 40, my sons being born, and a 15-year gestation period of this material. So,
yeah, Howard, what about for you? Because you managed to make 2 years of solitude in the Vermont woods, like read like a thriller. It's just a page-turning psychological thriller.
I guess,
when did you know that that could be a story to tell? When did you decide to tell it?
So I had no intention of writing about my time in the woods, and people often think that I was writing the book while I was there, or that I, of course, my plan was to write it, but I think that might be in part because of Thoreau. But it didn't even occur to me to write about it, and an editor had contacted me about a magazine piece that I wrote and was saying, maybe you'll want to write a novel, maybe you'll just, you know, get in touch with me. I like your writing, get in touch with me. And I kept thinking about different possibilities. Oh, he also said, maybe you want to do a nonfiction, a book-length nonfiction. And I kept trying to find some intriguing story, some true intriguing story, and I couldn't find, you know, I was concerned that I would just try to superimpose my story on whatever story I found, but I didn't feel, for whatever reason, the inclination or even the license to tell my story. And also, it didn't seem like it would make for a very good story because there's just a lot of snow. I mean, where's the narrative? Like, it snowed again, 12:30, snow still falling. I made soup, 1:40. You know, it's very hard to find narrative there. So, I eventually met with that editor. He encouraged me to, when he heard how I had lived and what I had done, he encouraged me in that direction. And I really, for 2 or 3 years into the writing of it, with all that snow and trying to find a narrative, I was pretty ambivalent about it. I didn't feel, as it seems, you know, some of the other panelists felt, that it was my responsibility to write it, or I'm sort of telling a story that someone else can't tell, so it's a responsibility. I didn't feel that way about it, and I wasn't quite sure what the justification was. And then I guess it occurred to me, I don't have children yet, I'll say, because my folks are here. I don't have children yet.
Don't worry.
But this is sort of strange. One day it occurred to me that, oh, if I do have kids, how would I possibly explain this really weird thing I did, that I went to live in the woods for? How would I possibly explain that to them, and how could I understand it in the larger context of my life? And maybe that was just a projection, sort of a convenient future projection for myself. How will I understand this myself later in my life? And then there was a justification. It's like, oh, this, here's something where you're on one trajectory, you go off and do something that seems so foreign to that trajectory, and then I didn't exactly come back to the trajectory I'd been on, but I came back. You know, I'm in Boston now, and I came back to the city. And so, how do you make sense of all that? Mm-hmm. So that was when I knew I was doing something I ought to be doing.
The next thing I want to know about, and I think this goes back to the question of sort of fact versus truth, is as you're shaping your memoirs, you're deciding what goes in, you're also deciding what doesn't go in. And in that sense, you're shaping the past in a very subjective way. How do you go about doing that? And what's the measure for what stays and what doesn't get in there? Mm-hmm. William, you talk about not putting your mother in your book, even though her presence kind of looms large throughout it. Maybe that's a good question for you to start with.
Sure. It's true. Right at the beginning of the book, I say that my mother is absent from these pages because she was largely absent from our lives, and that perhaps one day I will write her story when I've earned the mercy to do it. My mother's not in the book because it's a book about men. The first half of the book is about my adolescent years as a bodybuilder, growing up in a very masculine Italian-American Catholic household in New Jersey. My hometown's name is Manville. That's true.
Which no fiction editor would let you get away with.
It would never work in fiction. But it's a very small town outside of Princeton called Manville, named after the Johns Manville Corporation, that had a hub in this town. The town was really built up, mushroomed around this plant that produced asbestos materials. And the second half of the book is about my father's fatal crash racing motorcycles. And so with these two extremities of masculinity, strength on one hand and speed on the other hand, and the imprecations, the curse that this is to grow up with these ideas of manhood, of the masculine, what it's supposed to look like. This ethos of extremity, and males prove themselves with muscles or with speed. And they do these suicidal and very self-defeating things, whether it's anabolic steroids for bodybuilding competitions or this suicidal speed on back roads racing motorcycles. They do these almost exclusively within the realm of a group, right? So masculine behavior. I didn't know how my mother's story of abandoning the family fit into any of that. I tried to tell it that way because I could hear the criticisms. I knew what was going to be said. Where's his mother? Why is his mother not here? What, you know, this gaping absence, right? And so I just addressed it right at the beginning, Kelly, by saying, if you're looking for my mother, you're not going to find her here. Maybe she'll show up sometime in the future, but not here. That was a pretty... after I tried to fit her in, and it didn't work. It didn't work because the book was going to be 800 pages, and I couldn't have that. It was a simple decision. It was a liberating decision, actually, to say that... That's not the story being told here. So I think it's true what Kelly says, that you have to be certain of the story you're not telling, right, which is as important as your certainty of the story you are telling.
Anybody else want to weigh in on this?
Just briefly, I'm curious, how many fiction writers are in the room? There are several. So forgive me for what I'm about to say. The job of the memoirist... so much more difficult than what you fiction people do, because you decide, you know, I need to have an orange car in this scene, and so you write one. But if we don't have the orange car we need to make our memoir really work, then we have to do without it. And one of the challenges of the memoirist is to decide which story is the one that we're actually telling, and to know that simply because something happened doesn't give it a right to be on the page. When I wrote my first memoir, which starts when I'm 16 years old, so it begins where the second memoir concludes, I didn't mention the Doomsday Cult hardly at all, because it wasn't the story I was telling. I was telling the story of how my life sort of went off the rails for a few years before I got it back on track. And if I included too much about the Doomsday Cult, then it would require that I spend more time developing that, and then the story would spiral out of control. So when I wrote the second book, and it's exclusively about the Doomsday Cult, had I written the first book second And if you're slightly confused, that's okay, so am I. If I'd written the first book second, then I would have had to have continued on with the Doomsday Cult, because I would have established that in the first book, that this is a narrative thread of my life that's vital to what follows. So you really have to know what your story is, and you have to be able to keep the things out of the narrative you choose, even if those things happened and seem important, but they may not be important to the primary story.
Yeah, my process was very similar, trying to figure out what is the through line here, really what story am I telling, and it took quite a while to figure that out, because when I went to the woods, it was just, it seemed like there wasn't any other choice. I knew I had to go, so there's not a story there, there's just a decision. And in retrospect, it took a while to figure it out, and to finally figure out, well, it was very much about what shapes the way we see. So I had this accident when I was a junior in college. I was blinded in my right eye during a basketball game, and so of course my vision changed. I lost depth perception and some peripheral vision, but then I was 20, so all the questions that people are often asking when they're 20 about what's important, what should I value, how should I live, what should I live by, those questions came to the fore. And so those questions brought up questions of not just outer eye, but sort of your inner eye. What shapes the way you see? Whether it's socially constructed or whether it comes from something in your family or something really personal, what shapes how you look out at the world? And so I realized that's what I was doing. That's what I was doing in the woods, was trying to take away all of those things that have been socially constructed, all the tracks that we often follow, to try to understand, was there a way of seeing, was there something that sort of was more pure, and also that felt sort of more authentic to who I was, and could I find that, and then could I bring it back to living in the daily world. So once I understood that's what I was trying to write about, I then had the criteria for what scenes stay and what scenes go. And even if there were little anecdotes that were amusing, or there was more snow over here, or more soup over here, if it didn't have to do with that story, then those scenes got cut.
I wonder what effect writing your memoir has on your idea of your own mortality. How do you think about the span of your life? William, I imagine getting to your father's age will have some deep significance for you. You've both talked about having children and how that's caused you to reflect. Howard, you've promised your parents it's going to happen.
Did not promise.
Sorry, I misspoke. But not to make light of a serious subject, I mean, thinking about your own mortality, what happens with
I don't know if I talk about that in the book, Kelly. I think I might in the coda. I'm terrified of turning 47. I've no notion of what that's going to be like. The morning I wake up at 47 and know that I'm the same age my father was when he was killed, I can sense that it will be that overwhelming feeling of this is too soon, you know, this is much too soon. I mean, the difference, I think, is that my father's children were grown. I'll still have three little boys when I turn 47. I'm hoping that does something to temper the despair I'm anticipating. I'm not sure what to do about that. I can say that having children, like writing books, is a stay against your own mortality. It's what we have to keep ourselves here, present. If this memoir, if I wrote it in part for my kids, so they would know their grandfather, they themselves are an extension of my father. They are much like my father in ways that I could never be. They're really good on two wheels. They're really masculine, superheroing, rollicking little boys. They're very masculine little boys. I don't know what to do about this. They're fearless on bicycles, jumping from trees. I mean, I didn't ride a bike until I was 5 years old. I mean, I had to modify the smallest bike I could get for my middle son and my oldest son was still way too big for when they began riding. They were 2 years old, riding without training. They skipped training wheels entirely, right? And so I had other parents in Cambridge, and mind you, this is Cambridge, looking at this two-year-old buzzing down the sidewalk. I mean, he was almost in diapers still, on two wheels, looking at me like, are you nuts? Are you crazy? So when I saw that, their fearlessness in the masculine arts, whatever it is, karate or wrestling or all of this, I didn't have any of that. I said, oh, here's my father making himself known. Here he is, reinvented in this way.
So I'm going to have to jump in. I'm sorry. We're almost out of time, as I understand it. Can we open to questions? Good. Phew. I thought I blew through the audience questions. So I'm just going to stop asking my questions now, even though I could continue talking with all of you, and open it up. Would anybody in the audience like to ask questions of our authors? Sir. So just to repeat it so that everybody can hear, the question was about subjectivity in memoir and if you went back to people who were actually there to confirm, corroborate.
Well, it's an easy one for me to answer because there was no one else. There's no one else there. But I did talk to my family about my eye accident and that and some of the stuff that happened that night and also some of what they went through when I was in the woods. And it's really helpful. I mean, the idea that for a memoir you don't have to do research is almost always false, even if it's a memoir about solitude. Mm-hmm. It's so important to get other people's perspectives on that time. But I think the order of operations is really important, that you think about your memories first and try to jot those down, because if you ask other people before you do that work, what you remember will be shaped by what they say. Mm-hmm. And part of what can be really interesting is when your memories don't concord with other people's memories, and then you start to question why. So I think it's very important to talk to other people, but to make sure that you do your own work at reflecting first.
Oh, go ahead, Liz.
I was just going to say I think it's important to rely on your own memories. I think that I did fact check with other people, but most of the stuff in my book is kind of huge, and there's no question that it happened or didn't happen. That was not an issue, but the details, it's good to check. But I trusted my own memory, and often once at least too well, and the memory is wrong. But it's a fairly small issue, so I won't go into it.
More questions? Yes.
Say it's on. If you start talking with other people about what happened at a certain point in time or what their recollection is, it doesn't corroborate with your recollection. Which direction do you go in, or what happens at that point?
That's a good question.
I'm sorry, I'm having trouble hearing.
If your recollection, as you've laid out in your book, doesn't corroborate with what someone else has recollected, Which version of events do you go with?
Well, the things I asked about were things that, say, my son remembered, and I went with him because it was about him. So, I forget which one I made a big mistake on, but I think it was him, and he didn't bother. He told me, he said he'd read it, okay, but I don't think he really did. And I think that's why that's in there. It's quite small. It's about, he was a mountain guide, and it was about something that happened up in the Himalayas or something. Mm-hmm. Anyway, which I could have no knowledge of on my own, none. But so I had to rely either on what I thought he had told me or what anyway, whatever. I got a little bit of it wrong.
other perspectives on corroborating with your those in your book? It could be a question of collateral damage if they end up in your book and they don't want to be.
Let's see. I have many people who have not wanted to be in my books. And I don't want to be in theirs. But I can't stop them from writing their books, and they kind of can't stop me from writing mine. Your memory is your memory, and you have a right to it, and everyone has a right to their own. And someone else's memory isn't necessarily more valid than yours. So it's your story, tell your story. I was just talking to one of my colleagues yesterday about this very thing, and he told me a story of how he and his wife were driving one day, and they witnessed a boy be hit. He was on a bicycle, he was hit by a car. And so they had to give a statement to the police officer. And my colleague John said, the boy didn't stop at the light and went right through it. His wife said, no, he stopped, and the car went on the curb. Mm-hmm. And then the officer asked, well, what color was the car? And John said, the car was blue. His wife said, the car was red. And on it went with these conflicting accounts of what happened. Mm-hmm. So if John were to write this story, why would he go to his wife and get her details when they differ so much from his? That ultimately, if you are the author of the piece, own your own memory and tell it, and then allow people to have their own take on it from their perspective.
Mm-hmm. That's good advice. Fealty to your own memory. And besides, if you look at what the neuroscientists now are saying about our memories, it will horrify you. they're all wrong. It just, your life didn't happen the way you think it happened.
Even if you took notes while it was happening?
It just, yeah. You know this, have you read this? That every time you remember a memory, you alter it, right? And certainly every time you tell the story, you tell it a little bit differently from how you told it before, and then the next time it gets altered and all that. I mean, it's terrifying. I think what Gerald says is unimprovable. Loyalty to your own version of events, and let your family members fight it out.
I've got to say that if you take notes, you're going to have it right. And if you can remember well enough between the time you saw what you saw and the time you wrote it down, you're in business forever. It works. So.
It's never on.
Okay. You spoke a little bit about omitting things from your memoir. How do you choose to omit certain things? Well, are you not being true then to your memoir? Or if you take a memory and you imagine what might have happened, are you writing a novel? I mean, I'm writing a memoir, so
right.
I'm very confused about these things. Hi, Howie. I really enjoyed your classes very much.
Oh, thank you. So because of that compliment, I'll take a stab. I'm so easily seduced. So the part about if it happened and you don't include it, is it still a memoir? Well, if someone asks you at the end of the day, how was your day? What happened today? You're not going to include everything that happened in your day, unless you want to bore the person you're talking to. And what you'll talk about is the stuff, sort of what Gerald was saying, the stuff that asks to be remembered, or the stuff that asks to be told, which is easier, on the basis of a day than on the basis of a life. But I think it's fair. We're always omitting stuff, and we're not omitting necessarily to cover up or to make life easier. We're omitting for the sake of meaning. It's like photographers, it's sort of what Gerald was saying about nonfiction versus fiction. Fiction is like a painter, the canvas is blank. You have to fill it with whatever you want to fill it with. But being a nonfiction writer is more like being a photographer. There's stuff there, and it's up to you to frame it, and you're framing it for a purpose. You're right. Framing it to try to understand something about what you're looking at.
Right, and it's also true that just because you're not a novelist doesn't mean you're not telling a story. I mean, don't forget about the storytelling element here, right? I mean, this idea that, well, I'm just reiterating memories or giving a chronicle of what happened. I'm not really telling a story. No. Your memoir has to have every bit narrative structure, of storytelling armature, as a novel does. I think that's a misconception, that a memoir can be diary-like or journal-like. It can't. That storytelling apparatus is really important, I think. It's connected to what Howard is saying, right? And so, you know, madam, is the detail you're admitting, is it extraneous to the story you're telling? Right? I mean, that's the question you have to ask. Not everything that happened to you, not everything you remember is applicable, right? So,
as for me, there were people I would have liked to get revenge on, but sort of didn't. I mean, I didn't. Now I wish I did, but I lost my chance.
Now.
And other things leave out because they're boring, and I mean, really boring. And other things, I mean, I shielded people who were close to me a little bit. I mean, I didn't tell the whole bad story. A guy who was in our family ran over my daughter with a tractor and paralyzed her for life, okay? I didn't name him. I don't have to tell who it was. I left that out, because it's her story that was good. She became a leader for civil rights for disabled people, and now if you see somebody can get on a subway, a disabled person on a subway or a bus or something, it's because of her and others like her. They chained themselves to buses and stopped traffic. And she was in jail over 30 times. And I boast, I can never be in public without boasting about how many times she's been in jail. But they won, they got what they wanted. So thanks to this guy who ran over her, that wouldn't have happened. Anyway.
More, I see a question there.
Fiction writer, and she'll often, I've asked her this question before, if you had to write an amazing work or if you had to live an amazing life, which would you prefer if there was a choice there? And she answered that she'd prefer to write an amazing book. And so I'm wondering how memoir writing has actually shaped your interaction with reality. Does it feel like, you know, it's put you into a place of nostalgia? Has it actually enhanced or amplified your experience? Can you share a little bit just on how it's really changed your feeling of living?
Well, it's difficult for me to move through life without thinking everything is potential material. And whenever something happens that's out of the ordinary, I know it's material. I even say to myself, oh shit, this is material. And so I don't look for it, but I recognize it when it introduces itself to me.
I think it's a fascinating question. I mean, also just that choice, but I would hope that they're not mutually exclusive, that if you write a good book, it helps you, it can, especially if it's a memoir, it helps you to lead a better life, or at least, I mean, it depends what you mean by better, but a more meaningful life, a life that you've reflected on more. And for me, having written my memoir, I do feel that way. I feel like I'm more aware of why I made the decisions I made, and have a stronger sense of how that time in my life concords with what I'm doing now. And that, I think it's really how it's part of why we come up with narratives for our lives is not just to make meaning, but to have a sense of continuity. And we all have somewhat fragmented or fractured selves, and to try to understand that there is some way in which yourself is continuous is actually really helpful. Not necessarily for I forget the adjective used, but for, you know, sort of a great life, but for a meaningful life.
After? When you're writing, you have the internal eye. You can see inside yourself the way a reader can. And when you're writing about yourself, you always have that. But do you ever feel that when you choose to tell the story that you choose to tell, and the audience doesn't have that insight to all the little things that you didn't include that make you you, do you feel that something's missing? Even if it's an incredible work in the end, nobody else has any complaints. You know that you didn't include something that was important.
Why didn't you include it, though? Yeah, but why not? What's the choice that went into that? Why wouldn't you?
I chose to tell this story.
Yeah.
Because, you know, my biggest issue is how do you figure out what story to tell, what details to say for another story, and what if the company never makes it in, and nobody notices, nobody cares, it doesn't really affect the final thing that you as a person, the person who put everything into this, knows it's not there, because it didn't, there was no space, it didn't connect well enough, it didn't flow well enough, whatever. Does that bother you?
I think it gets to the question of what's the purpose of memoir, and it's not to have a representative for you. You know, here's sort of a document or a representative to send out into the world to, you know, sort of take hits that you don't want to take or to answer questions that you don't want to answer. It's to write a story, to make meaning of a particular part of your life, looked at from a particular vantage point, which is in another part of your life. And so the stuff that you leave out is the stuff, I mean, I think that's why you were asking that question, why, you know, the stuff that you leave out, as long as the stuff that's necessary for the story is there, that the stuff that's left out is actually generally a relief. Like, oh, I didn't bog down the story. And it also reminds me that the difficulty often isn't stuff you leave out and then feeling, oh, people didn't get that. It's the stuff that is so hard to say. You know, how do you get that across, the stuff that is, that seems ineffable? And there's a quote I love. Wittgenstein said, to express the inexpressible, express the expressible, and the inexpressible will be expressed inexpressibly. I just love that. Like, just say what you can say, and if you're faithful to it, all that stuff that you can't say will still somehow be evoked. Mm. And that's a huge relief, because then you realize the stuff you can't say, really, you can't say, and yet you can say it.
Yeah, you know, I can't speak for others, but for me, writing a book is so hard that I'm just glad to be done with it. That I don't know if other writers do this, but I don't ever go through my book saying, oh, I wish I had done that, or I wish I had done this. It's so difficult to write a successful book. And by the way, I think that writing a book should be a little bit like climbing K2. I mean, if it isn't difficult, you aren't doing it right. But I'd much rather be doing other things. When the book is done, I don't know. Do other writers do this? Look through your books and say, oh, I just don't want to see the thing ever again. You know. Am I alone with that?
No. We're with you. We're with you.
Same thing. Yeah.
We've got time for one more question from the audience. Yep. How do you write about an event that's so close to home you don't even know how to give it language?
Did anyone ever get the question? I mean, so if when you have these events, these occurrences, and they cut close to the bone, and you don't have the language for them, what do you do? You know, Wilde has got a great line, Oscar Wilde. He says it should be our belief that nothing is beyond our language, right? That everything should be expressible, rendered in language. Wilde did a very good job at that. I'm not sure the rest of us are Wilde. So what to do? I mean, this goes back to some of the earlier points we were making about the time that the material is marinating, right, gestating within you. I mean, I think all of these things come into play. And you know, how potent is your language? I mean, I think so much of what I find objectionable in so much memoir, and not just memoir, but much imaginative literature, is the inevitability of the language, right? That so many writers seem to me not to be trying very hard to make it new, to say it new, right? And for me, that's the main criterion for the success or failure of any book, really, is how well does the language get at it, right? Say it new. How original is the language? How potent is the language? Or is it full of lame inevitabilities, whether they're platitudes or cliches or what have you? So I think the question is really not just for memoirs, but for any writer who's attempting to put sentences on the page. How potent are your sentences? How original are you making it? Are you seeing it new? Are you saying it new? Or is this just automatic jargon? Is it just automatic writing? Memoirists are writers. They're not merely self-expressors, right? And so I think that's an important distinction. What to do if you don't have the language for something you want to tell? Any suggestions?
I mean, sometimes you might have the language, but you don't have the heart. And there are some subjects and some things that happen that are simply too difficult or too painful to be rendered on the page.
That's a really beautiful notion. I think we're going to have to leave it there. Mm. That was really well put. Thank you all for coming. Thank you.